Everybody, how are we doing this morning? All right. Hey, if you're new here or haven't been here for the last 19 to 25 weeks, that's okay. We are in the middle of a 30-week marathon series we're calling Believe, because it's a church and that's what we do here. And it's separated into three different groups of teachings. The first 10 weeks was all about stuff we think about. It was Theology 101. We talked about abstract concepts and what that means in Scripture. The second 10 weeks, which we're going to wrap up today, is all about the things that we act upon, the rhythms that we build into our lives as we pursue Jesus. And the last 10 weeks starts next week. And if you haven't gotten one yet, these are outside. We made nifty little bookmarks for you to stick in the cover of your Kindles. And it's got all the 10 weeks of the series. And the next 10 weeks is called Be. And we're going to look at essentially the characteristics of who we are when we go out and try and tell people to be more like Jesus. They're mostly fruits of the Spirit. So you can look at the schedule there. We're going to take a couple week break at the beginning of April for Easter because, you know, that's important. And we're going to talk about the resurrection of Jesus for 3 weeks. But other than that, all of our notes are given through a book that we have. And you can find the book out there if you don't have it in a study guide. Today is a little different. Today, when we looked at this about a year ago, and do we want to do it? What do we love about this series? What do we not like about it? There was a couple chapters we felt like were missing that we wanted to teach on. And it wasn't necessarily that we felt that there was anything terrible. It's just as we looked at our body, we said, hey, these things are important to us. This week is one of those weeks. And essentially what that is, what we're talking about today, is this idea of rest. And so a couple things you need to know. One, there's no chapter in the book about it. If you're looking, you can stop. You can go online under the resources section and you can find some notes that I wrote about it with some study guide questions if your small group is tracking along. But today we talk about rest. And what I want to do today is talk about why we need it, what the Bible says about it, and ultimately what it looks like in our world. Because rest is tough. It's really, really hard to be restful. I like presidential history because, you know, I'm wired like that. And so I listen to a presidential podcast that each hour talks about a different president. I love history. And a couple years ago, I came across this phrase written by Martin Van Buren, was the eighth president that we had. And the seventh president was Andrew Jackson. Martin Van Buren in 1829, when he wrote this to the president then, Andrew Jackson, was the governor of New York, right? And so he's seeing his times change, and he decided that it was getting so out of control that he was going to write a letter to the president as the governor of New York, and he's talking about trains. This is what he says. I love this. He said, quote, to Andrew Jackson, "Railroad carriages are pulled at the enormous speed of 15 miles per hour." He said, "The Almighty certainly never intended that people should travel at such breakneck speeds." Writing to the president saying, hey, you know what? That is outlandishly fast and it's gonna kill some people. Usain Bolt runs faster than that in the 100-yard dash. And why I bring that up is simply because it stuck out to me because I'm here now and 15 miles an hour was absorbently fast then. Now, if I'm not going at least 65 on 35, I'm yelling things that pastors shouldn't say out loud, you know? In West Texas, you can drive 80, and that's the beginning point. I'm a firm believer that 5 over is still within that range, right? And so if you're not going at least 85, I'm like, I'm up on you thinking, what are you doing? Let's speed up a little bit here. There's nothing out here but cacti. My point is simply that I think what Van Buren was referencing, we still have now, is that life tends to not slow down, but only speed up. It doesn't slow down, it only speeds up. He knew it then, we know it now. It's funny because we think sometimes that it will slow down as we become more evolved and advanced. Technology will help us slow down. In 1967, there was a group that presented to a Senate subcommittee on the future, Senate of the United States of America, and they postulated, they said, knowing where technology is at now and looking towards the future, by 1985, they said this to the Senate, by 1985, the average American will work 22 hours a week. They said they'll work 22 hours a week. They'll only work 27 weeks a year. 27 weeks a year. And they said, and the average age of retirement will be 38 because we'll be so advanced, right? I'm 33, don't see a road to that quite yet, but I'm looking. I love that. By 1967, we thought that technology was gonna carry us to places where we wouldn't have enough to do. But then in 1973, a study came out, we looked back and started documenting things, and a study came out a couple years ago that says that essentially leisure time in America has dropped 37% since the mid-70s. That the work week used to be about 35-ish to 40 hours, and now the average is 47 to 50 hours. And if you have a specialized job, most of the times it's upwards of 50 and 60 and 70. The point is simply, this world doesn't seem to be slowing down, but going in the opposite direction, no matter how advanced that we get. And so when that happens, we have to ask a question about how and what the effects are on us. And if you follow leadership journals or if you follow business articles and magazines, I read a couple like the Harvard Business Review, just this year had two separate articles that talked about our need to stop doing things. One was called, you have 168 hours in your work week. The other, I think, was called something like, hey, if you're working all the time, you're not working well. So from a business perspective, people are starting to recognize the toll that busyness has. Not just busyness, but this inability to stop and to slow down. So in comes this idea of rest, because life keeps getting faster and faster and faster, and we can't seem to slow it down. And so what happens when life keeps getting faster is either we fight for rest or it doesn't happen at all. It doesn't just magically appear. And here's what I want to do today when I talk about rest. I want to talk about what God believes about it, why he believes it about it, and then what it looks like. And let me be very honest with you. I am absolutely horrible at rest. There are things you teach that you know, and there are things you teach that other people know. I read a lot this week, right? Because I am very, my family will attest, and so will my friends. This is not one of my gifts. I don't like to slow down. And I think the reason for that, for probably a lot of us, and my dad built it in me, is because work matters. We live in a meritocracy where you are valued by what you produce and how much you produce. And so the idea of stopping production either seems just lazy altogether, it seems inefficient, or it seems selfish if you have a family and there's 17 different things you could do with that hour. 2 hours, 3 hours, where your kids need you and your family needs you and your job needs you and people are depending on you. So we don't. We don't rest because life's busy and we're important. But here's the deal. God talks about rest a decent bit in the Bible. So let's start at the beginning because it's always a good place to start. Go to Genesis 2. Genesis 2, if you don't know, is a creation narrative. The creation story. And essentially what he's doing, we're going to throw the verse on the screen if you don't have a Bible, but what's happening is God is outlining how he created, and he uses the reference point of days. So on day one, I made these things. On day two, I made these things. And all of chapter one is just what he created and the days that he created it. And he uses really one term to describe everything that he created. He looked at what he made and he said, man, this is good. In the fullest sense of the word, good. He got to humans on day six at the end of chapter one, and he said, it's not just good, it is really good. And then we flip to chapter two. After everything was made, he set this stage and then put us in it because he valued us and said, this is the best thing I've made. And you get to the beginning of chapter two, and it says this. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it he rested from all work of all the creating that he had done. Couple things to notice at the beginning. When it says that on the seventh day, God finished the work he had been doing, so then he rested. When it says rested, sometimes we infer our own meaning into the text. So when I think rest, I think tired. When I think rest, I think I'm exhausted, so I need to rest. Here's the problem with that. If God rested, then you're saying, if you believe that rest is something that's a byproduct of you being tired, that God was tired. God's omnipotent, God doesn't get tired. So literally, what we have to do is sit and talk about that for a second. And the Hebrew word for rest, Shabbat essentially, the Hebrew word for rest literally just means ceasing. It doesn't have a cause tied to it like tiredness. It just means I stopped doing something. Like if you're playing a basketball game and the buzzer goes off, you might not be tired, but it's over, right? So he's saying literally that God wasn't tired. He just stopped. And the question we have to ask is why? Why did God stop? And what we're going to talk about is how God modeled rest even from the very beginning, because it's something he wanted us to practice, because he didn't need to do it. So God rested to show us that rest is valuable. We model things sometimes we don't need to show its importance. I have a friend of mine whose kid just started eating, they say solid food, but it's like this gelatinous pea mixture, so I don't know. But we were at their place yesterday, and I couldn't help but think about, like, I'm sure you did it with your kids, but the airplane game, you know, like here it comes, and then, you know, one for dad. Look, no grown man needs to eat mashed peas like that, all right? You do it to model it for your kid that this is good behavior, so you should do it as well. And so what God is saying is, I stopped after 6 days and I rested because it's good. And what he does is he builds it into the life of his people. Go to Exodus chapter 20 with me. We're going to be here for a while, in and out. So Exodus chapter 20, to catch us up on the time in between, essentially is the laws of God. So God developed a people and he said, hey, it's all about restoration. There was a fall, there was a sin, there was something that didn't happen the way that I wanted to, and it caused pain and strife and broke the world. And the rest of the Bible is a story of God fixing it through Christ. And so in Exodus, God said, you know what? It's going to start with the people because I'm gracious, not because they deserve it. I'm going to pick a people and through them bring about a savior. And he takes them out of Egypt and takes them to a mountain. And he says, let me show you how to live. He gave them laws. And what we have to understand first and foremost, when we hear laws, when I hear laws, I think bad thoughts. Because sometimes I've gotten in trouble with the laws, like speeding, for example. When God made laws, he made laws with one purpose, to show people how life was supposed to be lived. He wanted to give them their best chance to succeed. It's like you do with kids. You don't make rules to make them miserable. You make rules so that they might flourish in life. So what they think is mean, like you can't eat Snickers for breakfast, you, in your wisdom, say this is good for you, know it. What you think is mean when you say go to school and do your homework, they might think that's terrible, but what you're saying is this is the better good for you. Trust me, I know these things. When God makes laws, it shows us two things. One, his character, and two, it shows us the best way life is supposed to be lived because he created it in the first place. So when I think law, I think some negative. We got to check those right there when we get to Exodus, because he's giving us the law. He gave about 600 of them, give or take, 613 exactly. He said, this is how I want my people to live. This is it. The headline of those 600 are the Ten Commandments, not because they're more important, just because they were written on stone, and that's cool. So in verse 8 of chapter 20, we're in the middle of the Ten Commandments, and it goes like this. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you'll labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you won't do any work. You, your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or the cattle or your visitor who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them. And they rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. So what we see from the beginning is God pointing back to what he did when he said to his people, this is how life's supposed to be lived. I rested, you rest. I model it so that you can now do it. Rest. He's saying, this is something that I did so that you might see it and copy me. Rest. And if you know anything about the Jewish faith now, they take Sabbath very, very seriously. They go to great lengths. In the Old Testament, they had 39, when Jesus came about, laws that protected Sabbath. We're controlling people, and we don't like non-specific rules. And so when they said, just remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, the Jews asked the question, what does that mean? We need to fill in the blanks for God. And so they did, and it came out of reverence. So they said things like, don't chuck wheat. They said things like, don't walk over a kilometer. They said things like, don't pick up your mat. 39 laws they put around it that you couldn't break, just to make sure that you weren't working on the Sabbath. If you go to Israel today, they still practice the Sabbath. If you go to Israel today and you get on an elevator on the Sabbath, they literally have a special running mode for the Sabbath. It's called Sabbath running mode. And what that means is they've now added to their list of things that are work, and they believe that pushing a button of a floor is work. So you don't push the button, you get on the elevator, and there's a couple different ways it happens. Either one, it just stops at all the floors all day long, or two, it goes to the very top and it stops on all the floors coming down. And you wait, because pushing a button is work. They respected Sabbath. But it didn't stop with the people. For the Jews, when God said rest, he wasn't just talking to the people. So often when we read scripture, we believe that it's only talking to individuals and forget that God made everything. And so when he says rest, God wove it into how his people functioned, how they treated their land, how they treated their livestock, how they treated each other. So he says every 7 years in Leviticus, you know what? Take a break from farming. Let the land Sabbath rest, cease from producing. When that happens, let your animals rest. He went on and he said there's going to be something called a year of Jubilee. And so every seven-year segment, at the end of seven-year segments, when the land has rested seven times, he said the 50th year is going to be the year of Jubilee. And what that means is you let your land rest, you rest, your livestock rests, you free all people from their debts. So like debts rest. You will return all slaves as free men. So what that which you've owned has now rested. It's this woven idea into his people that rest is good and extended far beyond just God took a nap on day seven. It extended far beyond, hey, you guys need this. So, you know, every once in a while, duck out early at work on a Friday. It was woven into how he expected his people to live. Because he said, man, this is good. I did it myself. So what we find as we read through the scriptures is one simple fact, is that essentially rest is a God-designed rhythm for our lives. It's not going anywhere. Rest is something that in every single way God said practice and practice often. And here's the cool thing that I like about rest is, and then we have to ask the question, what does it mean for us? Because we don't live under the Levitical law. We don't have to keep all 613. We look at the principles and said they were still good and God still rested and he still believes that life flourishes in the same way because he made it. And so we have to ask the question, what does it mean for us? And what I love, if you look back on Exodus 20, what I love about Exodus 20 is two things. There were two kinds of laws in the Jewish world. There were your thou shalts and your thou shalt nots, essentially. So these are the things to do and these are the things to not do. And normally each law was one or the other. But in Exodus 20, verse 8, the law about the Sabbath, which is the longest law that we have written down in the Ten Commandments, he says this, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. That is what you will do. Thou shalt do this thing. Expend energy pursuing this way of life. Thou shalt not comes next. 6 days you'll labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day, that's Sabbath of the Lord your God, and in it you will not do any work. Not you, not your son, not your daughter, not your slave, not your visitor. They will all stop. Thou shalt not. Because really what we talk about when we think of Sabbath, especially for the Jewish people, it was more than just a let's stop doing some things for a day. It was a lifestyle and it informed who they were. There was a Jewish author I was reading this week about Sabbath, because it's really fascinating how highly they view Sabbath. And he said this about what the Sabbath meant to the Jewish people. He said, each seventh day provided a full orbed reminder of who God was to his people. He is the source of their life. He's the provider of their freedom. He was the one who ordered their lives and gave them meaning. The Sabbath day provided a rest from the normal activities of life in the world and an opportunity for each believing Israelite to contemplate his roots and identity. It was more than just stopping. Because here's the deal, whether you were a Jew in BC 2500 or whether or not you were around at the time of Jesus or whether or not you're here now, life keeps getting busier. And if we don't fight that, we lose. And so what he's trying to establish when he talks about Sabbath through and through in the Bible is essentially this idea that you have to fight your desire to always produce. Because when you rest, bigger things happen than just, I don't do stuff and I have a little more energy. Because what the battle deep down inside of us really is about, what the Jews said with the Sabbath, it's about identity. It's about this desire that we have, especially as Americans in the West, to keep producing and be valued by the quality and the quantity of what we produce. We have to fight that. And God's answer is a routine called the Sabbath, or resting. There's an author, James Bryant Smith, who wrote The Good and Beautiful God. In it, he talks about rest. The chapter is called How to Make a Pickle. Don't ask me why. He says this, I love this quote. Satan does not always appear as a red devil, a ghastly monster, or the object of sexual desire. Sometimes he simply entrusts a false narrative, achievement equals value, into our minds. Once that narrative gets firmly planned, we are headed towards destruction without even realizing it. The narrative can sound almost Christian. That's why it slips by unnoticed. We may even think we're doing pretty well, but one day we wake up and realize that all the things that are most important to us, time with God and our family, our emotional and physical health, were sacrificed on the altar of achievement or the success of our church. And we have nothing to show for such an amazing sacrifice. It's tough to fight this desire to be productive and be valued by what we produce. I'm a pastor, and it is the hardest thing that I do to not look at the numbers each and every week and say we're good or bad because of them. It's really difficult, especially in this church of, in this world of mega churches that I live in called Flower Mound, you know? It's hard. And if we don't fight it, then we don't realize that it's happening all around us. We're being valued by what we produce. And God's answer to that seems to be rest, seems to be stopping. And what I love about what he says in Exodus, and this is what we're going to use to inform our definition of rest, is that two things happen because we don't fall under the law, but we have the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots. And so when we talk about rest, we're going to carry that principle into our definition, and essentially thou shalts is letting go of something and thou shalt nots is not doing something. So we're going to say biblical rest is the practice of letting go so that you can be filled. There's really two components to that. Thou shalt not. You're going to let go so that you can be filled. So stop doing something so that something else can happen. And both parts have to be present as we talk about what biblical rest is, because we're going to talk about it, but there's rest that's not biblical rest. And that's okay too, but not good all the time. And we see this idea of letting go, if that's the first part we're going to talk about. We see this idea of letting go all throughout the scriptures. Let's look at Jesus, for example. Mark 6. This is right after John the Baptist dies. So Jesus is hanging out with his disciples, and the author says, then, because so many people were coming and going that they didn't even have a chance to eat, he said to his disciples, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. A couple verses later, it continues, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up to the mountainside to pray. What I love about these verses, we see two instances of Jesus letting go of things. Crowds gather, he says, I gotta go. Crowds gather, he says, I have to go. And in the middle of that narrative, he feeds 5,000 people. 5,000 men, it was probably like 11 or 12,000 people. Pretty good moment for Jesus. And so what's happening is all these people gather around him and they're asking him, hey, help me, heal me, teach us more. And he says, man, I've got to go. And what I want to get to is simply the fact that sometimes if we're going to pursue biblical rest and that begins with letting go, the thou shalt nots anymore, we have to realize that we need to probably open up our palm and say, hey, I'm not going to control this for a little while. We need to let go. And the hardest thing about letting go, the very hardest thing about letting go, is more often than not, you're not choosing between good and bad, you're choosing between good and better. So it's not like it's, hey, you know what? Go get drunk or study the word. That's not the good and better. Usually it's hang out with my kid or do something that fills me. Or hang out with my friends or do something that fills me. You see the story with Mary and Martha in the scriptures, two sisters or two friends, and what happened was you have Jesus coming to their house, and Martha's like me, she likes to cook, and somebody came in, and so it's a very hospitable culture. And she says, let me make you some food. Mary plants herself at the feet of Jesus. And Jesus says in a little while, Martha, what are you doing? You're missing it, get in here, this is better. And what Martha was doing is not bad, it was awesome. She was trying to respect Jesus in the way they showed respect in their culture, time, place, and customs. And the point is, she just didn't choose the better over the good. So when we talk about what it means to let go, we have to start with this idea that we have to let go of things that sometimes are still okay. Because we are not good at letting go. I am awful at letting go of things. And when I say let go, I just don't mean release them forever, but for a time, for a space, for a moment, like the Jews did with the Sabbath, realize that I'm not going to try and control that right now. I will detach. And I think when we talk about life getting faster, one of the reasons is because there's not as many places that you or I can go to let go anymore. Because email was invented, and that screwed us all up. Because now anybody can reach you anytime, any place, and expect you to respond, right? So let's look at email for a sec, because I got into this a little bit. Let's look at email kind of as a litmus for how well we let go. There's 269 billion emails sent a day on this earth. Out of that, let's narrow it down a little bit to America. If you're here, if you work in an office building, on average, there's 120, this is 2016, 121 emails the average office member receives in a given day. 121, that's the average. There are less, there are more. Some of you are saying, I get that by breakfast. Some of you are saying, I don't have an email account. That's fine, right? This is just the median. So 121 of the average that an office worker gets a day. Let's look at some percentages. 42% of Americans check their email while in the bathroom. I know what you're saying. I would never do that. But we all have, don't lie to me, this is church, all right? We can't even detach from email while we're in the bathroom. We don't even talk about if you wash your hands. The next stat, 18% of Americans check their emails while driving. I know you're all thinking, I would never do that. It's too dangerous. I've seen the PSAs, but it still happens at a pretty good clip, 1 in 5, because we're not good at letting go for the 15 minutes it takes to drive anywhere. The next one we have up here is 50% of Americans check their emails while in bed. I can give you article after article that I've read about how it's terrible to check your emails while in bed. Let your bed be your safe space, because then you sleep better, your body knows it, you're not being productive there. The last thing I do before I go to bed and the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning while in bed is check my email. And I know it's not good. This is from actually 2016 in November, and it said that 50% of us do the same thing. This last one is my favorite. 79% of American white-collar workers check their email while on vacation, their work email while on vacation. So when I got married, I went on a honeymoon like you do, and I remember having a conversation with my wife where I usually try and start, you know, small, and I said, hey, look, here's the deal. Busy time at work. I'm gonna bring my work laptop. I'm just gonna work like maybe an hour a day. That's it. And she said, it's our honeymoon. And I said, you are absolutely right. 30 minutes. Tops. It's a conversation we had. And she's like, no. And I was like, I get it before you. What if I get it before you? What about like 20 minutes? Just a couple emails. I know what you're thinking right now. How are you still married? I don't know. She's lovely. But that's a real conversation that I have. I am horrible at this. I take it everywhere. I always check emails. I can't detach myself and let go. It doesn't happen. And it's harder and harder and harder the closer we get because of technology, not easier and easier and easier like some people said it was going to be. Biblical rest involves letting go. The simple question is, how good are we at letting go? I think it could be a really easy, maybe practical application to, I think tech is the first thing we go to, like your phones. I read something yesterday, said the average American touches their phone, interacts with their phone like 86 times a day, I believe. And so what if I have some friends who, they have a bowl in the middle of a table when they go out to eat, everybody puts their cell phone in the bowl, the first person to check their cell phone pays for the whole meal, you know? Really easy way to not make me wanna pick up my cell phone. Because the one thing I like more than emails is keeping my money. I'm my dad's son. Maybe it's just, hey, we have a no tech policy at the dinner table. My wife's helped me out with that. I'm not good at that either. Maybe it's things like I have friends that do Sunday afternoon that's a pastor, and once he gets done with work, his phone is off until Monday morning. It's just off. Maybe it's not technology that keeps you tethered. Maybe it's a space. So if every time you're in, like your office at home, if you work from home, you can't stop but being plugged in, not letting go. So you shut the door, lock the door, give your wife the key, and don't go in there for a day a week. I don't know. What would it look like to let go? Because it's a hard thing to do. So we talk about the thou shalt nots, the ceasing from things, but that's just not all of what rest is. Biblical rest is more than that. So it's, hey, thou shalt nots, but it's thou shalt's too. So biblical rest also involves being filled. Back in Exodus chapter 20, verse 8, he says, Remember the Sabbath, in your version either says, and keep or by keeping it holy, either one. The Hebrew word for holy has its root in the Hebrew word for betrothed. So when I say like you're betrothed to be married, and essentially what that means is holiness means literally to be set apart, but it means I'm pledging myself towards something, I'm committing to something. I'm committing to make this different than other times and places and spaces. So what the Jews did, Saturday afternoon didn't look a whole lot different if you just looked outside onto a field than Friday afternoon. But it was different because they made it different in the way they approached it, in their attitude, in their mindset. We do this all the time. So Valentine's Day was a couple weeks ago, right? And for some reason, because Hallmark is Hallmark, we have picked out a day of the year we're supposed to love our spouses. Again, I've convinced my wife that day doesn't matter. She's still married to me. But on February 14th, even though it's just like February 13th and just like February 15th, we wake up and we think, we train our minds to believe this day matters in a different way. That was Sabbath. We do it with birthdays and we do it with anniversaries. The day of your birth, after you're already born, looks just like the day before it in a lot of places. But we give it meaning and we celebrate, and that is good because we approach it with a different mindset than we do the Tuesday before. Because we're saying that, hey, you know what? This is gonna matter. That's what it means when it says make it holy. You pledge or commit to make something different, to be set apart. So when he's saying remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, he's literally asking them to do the same thing. Mark Buchanan wrote a book on rest. It's really good. If you can look it up on the Google and the Amazon. He said the difference between regular time and Sabbath time couldn't be sharper. Sanctifying some time adds richness to all time, just as an hour with the one you love brings light and levity to the hours that follow. To spend time with the object of your desire is to emerge, not sullen and peevish, but elated and refreshed. You come away filled, not depleted. So here's the deal, is that we have to understand when we talk about what it means to be filled up, there's a difference between just going through our Tuesday and going through our Tuesday in a way that we engage in something which fills us up. Because when we think of rest, so much we think it's just the opposite of work. But rest, in fact, is not the opposite of work. It is a commitment to do the things that fill you up. And we see it all the time. So at CBC, for example, we talked about camp in the city. I don't know if you guys worked at a summer camp or have been to a summer camp or have been here during Camp in the City. I don't engage with it at all by choice, and I am exhausted at the end of it. There are 30-something Pine Cove counselors, and all they do that I can see is jump up and down and chant things. And they run around with kids and they teach them Jesus. And I did camp, I did something like that in San Francisco for a summer. I've never been more tired in my entire life, but these Pine Cove counselors leave, and they are so full. Every year, we get adult volunteers that give up their vacation time to help high school kids build a house in Mexico. They drive 27 hours with high school kids in vans, people, all right? The love of the Lord compels them. They drive there, they build a house in a week, and it's all done by hand. And if you have never mixed concrete by hand and laid a slab, I would say don't try. Just let Home Depot do it for you. But it's exhausting. It's exhausting, but our high school leaders, Amy Anderson, who was up here before, come back year after year after year, and you come back tired but so incredibly full. There's a difference than time and Sabbath time. There's a difference between time, things that fill us up and things that don't. And actually, the Greeks knew this as well. The Greeks had two words for time. The first one was a word that was the same word as one of their gods. And so they have Greek mythology, lots of gods. And there are your big gods, Zeus and Aristotle and Aphrodite, and there are your smaller gods. Kronos is the word that they have for time, one of the two. And it was also a Greek god. And that Greek god was not a good man. Not a good man at all. You can read about him. But essentially, he was not a good man because everything he did, he consumed for his good and nobody else's. Everything. So when the Greeks talk about time, if they talk about time in a way that's not life-giving, if they talk about time in a way that simply talks about the passing of it as it marches on, they call it Kronos. But they have another word for time that's really pretty great, and it kind of is the opposite of Kronos in a lot of ways. Kairos. Kairos is a time that essentially is a gift. It sees time as a gift. It sees time as an opportunity, as something that can be developed and develop you in the way as it goes along. The difference between the two kinds of time is chronos time asks, hey, just what time is it? As a matter of fact, and kairos time says essentially, what's this time for? And there is a world of difference in between those two questions. One gives life and one doesn't give life. So I love that idea because I think we have to process that when we talk about Sabbath. Because it's not just Netflix and chill for rest, you know? And I think there's time for that, but we've all been there before. You lay down, you need to rest. Like you need the rest. The Bible talks about rest, not just I need to sit on my couch. And so what you do is you sit and you say, I'm just gonna turn on Netflix for a second. I'm just gonna turn on Netflix. And before you know it, it's next Tuesday and you haven't bathed, you know? You just binge. And what happens is an hour passes, 2, 3, 4 hour passes. And you realize, man, I rested, but I'm not full at all. And that kind of rest is not what the scripture's talking about. When God says you need to rest, because it is both these elements of you need to let go and be filled up. And if they're not happening, biblical rest isn't being accomplished. I'm not saying don't watch Netflix, by the way. That's great. Please, I'll give you a list of shows you should watch. But what we want to do is ask the question of what fills us up. There's a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi, and I loved this quote. He's talking about Sabbath and how you rest. And he said it like this. He said, if you work with your mind, Sabbath with your hands. If you work with your hands, Sabbath with your mind. And I like that because I work behind a desk most of the days and I read and I write. And when I rest, a lot of the times, because I do that all day long, usually it involves activity for me. So yesterday, I went and dug out some sprinkler heads, broke my friend's house, and filled mulch in his backyard. Because I'm not handy, but I try to be. And that was restful for me. I got to let go of things here. I got to let go of my sermon for a couple hours. I got to let go and be filled with community and be filled with work, and it was good. I like the idea that resting sometimes means you exert energy, so it's a novel concept, but what if in order to rest, you actually had to set the alarm and get up earlier? And it's not just sleeping in, because it's things that fill you up. I asked some staff this week, what does rest look like for you? And Jonathan, the amazing husband that he is, actually said, rest looks like when I clean my house. I said, oh my, that's lovely. It's kind of the same idea. Mike said that rest is coffee and a chair and a book. Steve rests a lot when he rides bikes or when he takes pictures. And so I love the broad berth that we give this idea of rest, because really what we're asking is what does God use to fill you up? What is rest for you? What allows you to step back from those things that oftentimes make you busy and worried? And then what fills you up as God is working through it? So it could be a lot of different things. But God says find spaces and places for both. And what I like the most about the idea of rest, and what I think it all comes down to, is we either trust God that rest is part of his design or we don't. And what I mean by that is, we either trust when God says this is how life's supposed to be lived or we don't. And so we can sit here and talk about what rest should be all day long, what it is and what it isn't. But what it comes down to is, do you trust God when he says you need it? So ultimately, rest essentially is an exercise in trust that increases our peace and our hope in the character and the nature of God. And what I mean by that is, in the Jewish world, rest was more than just a day of the week. It centered their whole week because it reminded them that God was in control and they weren't. One Jewish rabbi, another guy named Abraham, and you know that he's a Jewish rabbi because his parents named him Abraham. He had no other choice. He said it like this. He said, there's a realm of time, the Sabbath, where the goal is not to have but to be, not to own but to give, not to control but to share, not to subdue but to be in accord. Life goes wrong when the control of space, the acquisition of things of space, becomes our sole concern. I think the beauty of Sabbath that sometimes we miss is that it puts into perspective God's world and ours. And instead of thinking of Sabbath as something we do because we need it, we need to think of Sabbath as something that kind of recenters, reorients, gives identity to our entire world. And what that does is it increases its value. So then I can't ask you, do you need Sabbath rest? And you can't say, if you believe that, no, I'm good. I'm too busy this week. In Matthew chapter 11, Jesus says it like this. Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and you'll learn from me. and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And what he's talking about is both the here and now and the future. He's saying, come to me and you will find rest because you don't have to earn it all on your own. Be reminded of that. And one day we're going to do this for a long, long time together. It's this idea that when we acknowledge that we need rest, we acknowledge that God's in control and we're not. I was reading this week and I came across a kind of just a training mechanism that pilots use. And it was interesting, so I'm going to read you it because I don't want to get it wrong because my father-in-law is a pilot and, well, I'm still afraid of him. It says there's an exercise that some pilots go through late in their training. He says a student pilot gets the plane airborne and at cruising altitude. Then the instructor places a loose-fitting, thick-woven sack over the student's head so the student can see nothing. The instructor takes the controls and starts stunt piloting. He loops and he loops again. He pushes the plane to a headache-style skyward drive. Then he flips belly up and swoops earthward. He rocks and he spirals. He careens and he nosedives. He tailspins and he wing tilts, whatever that is. He gets the student utterly discombobulated. Then he pulls the plane into a suicide dive, plucks the bag off the student's head, and hands him the controls. Says his job is to get the plane back under control. Here's where I say that. I think life speeds up, and it's not going to get any slower. I think life is going to flip us around some days, and some days we'll be up, and some days we'll be down, and some days we'll be good at emailing, and some days we won't, but life's just going to get faster. What if the idea of rest, God's designed rhythm for our life that we practice on a continual basis, what if that was the process by which we were centered again? What if that was the process by which God reminded us that he's in control, that we have hope, and that it's okay if we don't have all the answers? What if Sabbath was that thing that God said, do this and other things will fall into place, because that's what it was for the Jewish people. As they stopped doing things and got filled by God doing other things, they were reminded that God was good and that God was in control. And so it became the center of their week that grounded everything else. Because the problem is, we can do rest, but if rest becomes a checklist like everything else, then I don't think we're doing rest the right way. And so God says, I designed you for rest. You know that, right? Look at what I did. There's an author that I really like. Her name's Lauren Winner. And she writes a few books that I'd recommend, but one of them is a book about her changing from Judaism to Christianity. And she was a practicing Jew, so she went pretty hard with it. She did everything you're supposed to do. And she practiced Sabbath well. And what I mean by that is she would talk about how she would cook all of her meals on Friday night before sundown. You gotta get them all in because you can't cook on the Sabbath. Her and her husband would rush to the shower to make sure they showered before sundown because you're not showering for another day. They were trying to get all the work they had done before sundown because they weren't working for a day. And then she talked about becoming a Christian and not celebrating Sabbath anymore. And people asked her questions. They said, well, I don't see the point in all of those things. It seems over the top. Why do you stop doing different things just for Sabbath? And this was her answer. They said, what happens when we stop working and controlling nature? She said. When we stop working and controlling nature, when we don't operate machines or pick flowers or pluck fish from the sea, she said, when we cease interfering in the world, we're acknowledging that it's God's world. That's Sabbath. It becomes something that we just don't get to do if we have a light week, but something we need to do because our week is heavy. It's a rhythm that God designed that we are supposed to live out because he said, this is what good life looks like. Join me and rest. Let me pray for us. God, I'm thankful that you are here, that you're God of rest. I pray as we worship just a little bit more that this space can be somewhere where we can let go and be filled by the Spirit. As we talk about our need for God, Sabbath is a reminder that we still have a need for God, that we can't control anything, but he is at the center of our world. May we think about how rest centers our life and propels us forward. So give us the courage to practice rest. Give us the ability to model it to our friends and our family and our kids, and help us to follow Jesus. And part of that means we rest. I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.